Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to bring in Thomas Phillipson. Tomas Phillipson is the former chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He's now professor of public policy at the University of Chicago. Tomas, thank you. So I want to talk for a few moments about your article in the Wall Street Journal. Biden turns the U.S. into a shadow member of OPEC. A government cartel, and that every step he takes, Biden, to stop fracking and permitting and pipelining strengthens the cartel and keeps prices higher than they would ordinarily be. I believe that's what your point is, but you tell us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Larry. So cartels are obviously illegal in the private sector. We have antitrust laws that prevent them, but they are permitted between governments, ironically enough. In fact, OECD is trying to run a price cartel led by our Treasury Department of having corporate tax floors so that companies or countries, I should say, don't compete with each other in terms of corporate tax competition. OPEC is the most famous government cartel, and it's important to understand sort of the incentives of a cartel, how it works, which is you try to hold down supply to keep prices high. When demand slopes downwards, the only way to get up prices is to have less of it. And there's an inherent incentive for cartel members to cheat if other people stick to the script. So if other countries stick to their supply cuts, it's to the benefit of a given country to sell more at the higher prices, but thereby eroding the higher prices. So there's a huge instability of a cartel. So the cartel likes people to commit to supply cuts, and that's exactly what Biden has done for the U.S. He's committed to supply cuts with legislation and regulation, and also in the financial sector by basically trying to enforce regulations that limit financing of fossil fuel or oil companies. And it's that commitment through regulation and legislation that's so valuable to OPEC, because traditionally U.S. would step in, they would constrain the cartel, because if the cartel went in and cut supply, U.S. could actually fill it, and therefore they constrain the higher prices of OPEC. But now we're in a situation where the U.S. is basically committing not to do so, which is great news for OPEC, bad news for consumers, particularly poor ones.
So basically, you want to bring back the Trump policies, which were deregulatory policies, which were policies that promoted the expansion of the supply of oil and offset OPEC. I mean, every time I can recall national security issues, Tomas, I mean, this is kind of interesting. You know, Iran bombing Saudi Arabia, Iran and Yemen, you know, people worried about sanctions in Iran or anything that would cause prices to be driven up because of what these Middle Eastern producers or OPEC members would do. But I used to argue in these national security meetings that we shouldn't worry about that because we have so much supply. Essentially, the world was awash with oil, and oil was averaging about $50 a barrel. And frankly, it didn't matter what OPEC did. Now, all of a sudden, right. So your point is, because Biden's climate change extremism has curtailed production, we are playing along, so we are a shadow member. We are bolstering OPEC's power, not stopping it.
Exactly. And then the key word is commitment by regulation and legislation. They can count on us not being in there and trying to counteract what they're doing when they're raising prices through their cartel, because we've committed. It's going to take a lot of work to uncommit that legislation and regulation so they can count on us not responding to what they're doing by basically being a, you know, a pivotal producer in the world market.
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting and vexing subject. I mean, here's Biden going, you know, hand in hand, hat in hand to the Saudis, produce more. Lately, the Venezuelans produce more. They're playing footsie with Iran, Tomas, right? You know, for a nuclear deal that would be a terrible mistake in foreign policy terms. All we have to do is open the spigots here. Why is that so hard to understand?
Well, I mean,
open the spigots. Turn the dials, for heaven's sakes. Why is that so hard?
Well, I mean, they will obviously argue that this is for the benefit of reducing global warming. And there's several problems with that. One is U.S. energy is obviously cleaner than the rest of the world's energy. So you're actually many times increasing global warming by substituting away from U.S. energy. The second one is it should be a complete focus on innovation into green energy, if you want, as opposed to prevention using existing technologies. So we're substituting into more costly green energy away from cheaper fossil fuels. If fossil fuels were more expensive, they would be abandoned by the market a long time ago. The problem is that, you know, green energy is more expensive, but we're pushing people, which is really hurting the poor. It's a very regressive agenda, to be honest, because the poor are the ones that are spending a larger share of their budget on energy compared to rich folks. So it's a very regressive agenda of not focusing on innovation. Once this innovation, I mean, you know, we're getting great news on fusion this week, right? But, you know, that's going to take decades. But that's the kind of innovation that's going to get us out of it. It's not substituting to more costly energies. And this stupid kind of discussion of Biden that we're creating green new jobs is like arguing if we had government subsidies for typewriters, we have all these new typewriter jobs replacing computers, it would be great. So I think it's completely misunderstanding, you know, that the key to this is innovation. It's not replacement of cheap energy for costly energy.
Do you still have your typewriter?
I don't have it. I don't have it.
I don't have it either. I had, what was it called? Olympic or Olympia? I had one. I wasn't any good at it anyway. I love that, the typewriter analysis. You know, we were talking earlier with John Carney at Breitbart about these climate banks, Tomas. They're set up in the Inflation Reduction Act, fraudulently named. They set up these climate banks. There's a bunch of them. And, you know, they're going to allocate money. God knows how much money. There's about $30 billion that maybe would be the capital. And then they'd make loans to various projects. And then we learned this week, Tomas, about all this Energy Department subsidies to battery companies. The trouble is the battery companies are owned by the Chinese. Okay.
Of course.
I thought we were in favor of onshoring. So we've got climate banks with unlimited budgets, and we've got battery subsidies for Chinese. I don't get this. This doesn't sound right to me. But you're the distinguished former CEA chair. Tell me where I'm wrong.
I mean, the whole issue is this is very, very similar to COVID. It turns out, in my view, because for COVID. What we did, we're trying to prevent disease by having people locked up or, you know, reducing face-to-face activity, which is very costly. It was a lot of foregone economic activity from doing so. What saved the day for COVID was innovation, essentially, in terms of the vaccines and treatments. And it's going to be the similar story for green energy. It's not going to be that we're going to substitute towards more costly green energy. That's not going to be the solution, especially for the poor. It's going to hurt the poor a lot more than it hurts the rich. And it's going to be that we have new innovation where we basically bring down, as soon as we bring down, you know, renewable energy prices below fossil fuels, it will not, we won't need governments to kind of mandate anything, right? The market is going to go there if it's cheaper. And that's the innovation that's needed. And it's very little focus on that compared to substitution away from, you know, cheap to costly energy.
And your other point, we're running out of time, but Tomas, your other point, fossils are cheaper than the wind farms or the solar firm. That's a key reason why there's only 3-5% of these other alternative renewables, so-called. It's just too damn expensive. That's your point?
Well, that's a key reason we have global warming. If it was more expensive, we wouldn't need fossil fuel, right? The market would just go to greener energy automatically, and we wouldn't have the problem to start with. The whole issue is that the cost of fossil fuel is cheaper. But the green energy costs are coming down over time. They're not coming down as quick as we want them, but they will come down below fossil fuels. Once that happens, the market is going to go there. You don't need any government subsidies to go there then.
All right, you got it. Tomas Phillips from the University of Chicago, former head of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Trump administration. Thank you, Tomas. I'm Kudlow. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk about innovation, fusion versus something or other, fusion versus fission. Mark Mills will tell us about it from the Manhattan Institute. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back. Excuse me. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Larry Kudlow. So Tomas Phillipson was talking about innovation and technological breakthroughs to solve the issues of climate change and climate warming. And sure enough, this past week, we had announcement from the very famous Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory out in California that made some headway in something called fusion. Well, I'm going to let Mark Mills from the Manhattan Institute, he's going to describe this. I don't know. I don't understand anything about this stuff. This is like, it's, what are we doing? Nuclear reaction, when we split the atom, it's called what?
It's fission.
Fission.
And you split big atoms. Uranium is heavy like lead.
Right.
It's big and you can split it relatively easily.
Right.
And it releases that famous conversion of matter to energy, the E equals MC squared, we've all heard so much about, even if we don't understand it.
Right.
Just means it's a crazy big number, millions of times more energy per pound of material than combustion or wind or solar, just incredibly more energetic. It's great stuff. And then.
So I knew that.
Fusion.
Wait, I knew fusion. That. I knew that.
Yeah,
I knew that. E equals MC fusion. Squared. Yeah. Now, fusion is
fusion.
What?
So that's what stars do. The center of a star, it's kind of a big thing, the star. They're huge. It's not the sun. Under incredible pressure and high temperature, you push the hydrogen atoms together, makes them bind. That also results in an incredible release of energy. It's the inverse. You're making a bigger atom out of a small one, but it also is it's an atomic phenomenon. Incredible. We've been trying to replicate fusion ever since we understood what fusion was and how we knew how stars worked. It's really remarkable. You know, this announcement deserves a lot of credit for being an incredible breakthrough in science. They got to ignition. You know, when you turn your car on, you get ignition. But to use a simplistic analogy, if you got a car engine to have ignition, but you didn't have the rest of the engine, I mean, if you just get combustion ignition, but no engine, no wheels, no steering wheel, no car, you don't have a vehicle. I mean, this is a big step in science. It doesn't tell you anything particularly useful about how soon we'll have practical fusion, although with maybe one caveat. The joke in the physics community has for 50 years been fusion is always 50 years away.
Mm, right.
But with this discovery, it might actually be only 50 years away, finally. We may now finally have the roadmap. We it might be close, which is 50 years.
Well, when you were talking about having an ignition in the car, you turn the ignition on and nothing happened. Well, that's what the Bidens are doing, right? Because they won't let you have gasoline in the car. So you turn on the ignition and nothing happens. Now, the point here is that was a joke. Just kidding.
I know, having some fun because I know you will.
But fusion is renewable, okay, right? Fusion is not fossil. It's a fabulous innovation. But you're saying it, I mean, the press reports were like decades away. You're saying it could be, you know, 50 years away. Or is that, you know, I don't want to be optimist or pessimist. I don't understand anything about this. I'm just asking you, how soon can this be done practically and commercially?
Well, it's probably more than decades away. Only you just need to know two things that are sort of useful fact points. And there's in some of the press coverage. It's usually buried. The amount of energy taken from the grid to produce the fusion energy is the key thing. You want more energy coming out than you put in. That's called energy production, not energy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 200 to 300 times more energy taken from the grid to produce a unit of energy from fusion at that breakthrough. So we're not close in that sense. To have a useful energy-producing machine, the stuff you put in, the energy and materials, you have to get 100 times more out, not 100 times less.
Oh, right.
That's where we are. Ignition was a physics breakthrough, not a practical breakthrough. The other thing is the fuel pellets. I mean, you know, gasoline is a fuel. The solar photovoltaic cell is sort of, in a sense, a fuel. You know, it costs money to make. The fuel pellet to do the fusion reaction, each pellet costs about $1 million to be handcrafted.
Hmm.
And they can sort of light one up sort of once a day. You're going to have to light 10 a second up to make a power plant and figure out how to make millions of those pellets for, you know, dollars, not millions of dollars. And that, I think, we'll conquer that problem, but it might take, you know, 30 to 50 years. It's going to take time.
But you have to get it into some kind of energy grid.
Well, that's right? More detail. Yes.
I mean, you're saying here in this New York Post article, I think it was New York Post, each unit of laser energy put into the fuel pellet gobbled 200 units of grid energy.
Yeah.
A lot of work needs to be done. So you got to somehow get it into the grid, which then would promote the electricity to power whatever, the economy.
Well, you could, you know, you make heat. Basically, the fusion reactor would make heat, just like we burn fuel to make heat or split atoms to make heat. And you make electricity from the heat by, you know, boiling water, spinning turbines. So that part isn't the hard part. The hard part is you have to produce more energy than you consume. And we aren't there with fusion. We're not even close to there with fusion. It's, you know, and of course, electricity, the important thing here, and this is some kind of magical breakthrough, it's important again in science, but about a quarter of the world's energy is used in electrical form. So 3/4 of the rest is not electricity. So if we had a magic way to make electricity, that's meaningful. I mean, but it doesn't change everything.
Mm.
In fact, the way to change everything, if you want more carbon-free electricity, is to promote today, now, many more of the conventional nuclear power plants that we already know how to build.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not very popular with most places. It's starting to become more popular slowly, but it's we've had 40 years of hysterical anti-nuclear opposition. So the things that we know how to use, we oppose. The things we don't know how to build, we support. It's kind of infantile.
Well, the base energy load, I mean, I've heard this from a lot of people. Rick Perry has said this. Dan Brietta has said this. You know, people worked in the energy department, Steve Koonin. I mean, the base energy, Mark Mills, is got to be natural gas and nuclear, right?
Sure.
Isn't that those are the
electricity? For transportation, oil,
clean burning.
Oil. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's right. So transportation, that's still going to be stuck on oil, right? What else
we
got?
Long time.
Well, the Bidens are doing a great job. They want to stop all that.
Well, Newsom, as we've talked about before, Governor Newsom has joined a bunch of other states and countries banning the purchase and sale of internal combustion engines.
Mm-hmm.
a mere decade from now, on the belief that electric cars can eliminate oil use, and they're practical. I mean, you know, electric cars are nice, but the reality is where we're sitting today is about 1% of the world's transportation is done with electric vehicles. So 99% of the world still using engines that burn fuel. Even the most optimistic forecasts will have something like 60 to 70% of the world's transportation burning oil. And then you've got the whole problem of the oil that gets burned to make the batteries to make the electric vehicles,
right?
Which is a big number, a huge number.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so Newsom wants to end the combustion engine and gasoline-powered cars. But even if you own an electric vehicle right now, he's telling you you can't recharge it because he doesn't have enough electricity, because he won't let anybody, mine for natural gas.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Really? I mean, isn't that his dilemma? I mean, I know Gavin. Well, I know Gavin Newsom, but these are very extreme. I mean, these are extremely extreme ideas of his.
Well, they are, and we do know that he's not stupid. I've met him once.
He's a smart guy. I totally agree with you.
And when I met him, I found him. This when he was governor. The governor was rather mayor of San Francisco. He was charming, smart,
right.
Engaging. I mean, he'll be a formidable candidate without any question.
Couldn't agree more, Mark, by the way, personally, on a personal level.
Oh, he will.
I couldn't agree with you more. He's a good guy.
I think he is.
He just has crazy ideas now.
Well, you know, maybe he'll be like Bill Clinton and change and move to center. Who knows? But here's what we do know is that he was clearly told behind closed doors that the policies he's pushing will lead to blackouts in California. That's the only explanation for him signing legislation to keep their nuclear plant alive, and actually sign legislation to pay to keep it alive and running, because the push to more solar and wind on California's grids, even as they add more electricity consuming cars, and they're leading, quote unquote, the country in that, they're heading off a cliff, and he was told that. And so to his credit, he changed his mind. And he also authorized last year, quietly, the construction, emergency construction of, to your point, natural gas-fired combustion turbines in order to keep the grid lit. So,
right.
Good for him.
Well,
good for him. Maybe reality will hold. Maybe.
All right. So fusion and fission, we got a ways to go yet for this fusion stuff. Mark Mills, as always, I actually understood this, at least for the moment. I may forget it later this afternoon, but I got it. Mark Mills, nobody better. Folks, I'm Kudlow. We are going to take a break, and on the other side of the break, as we always do, we're going to do some stock market work. It was kind of an ugly week for stocks, but we got a couple of sharpshooting experts that are going to help pilot us. I'm Kudlow. Please stick around.
Larry Kudlow.